Buddhist Summer School, Monday afternoon, 31st August 1981. There are several words out of the Eastern scriptures which are coming into common use in the languages, all the languages of the world. I think all over the world, the word nirvana has a place in the ordinary dictionary. Another such word which is coming into common use is the word karma. And all of us here and in groups which are interested in these matters know this word karma. But we may wonder whether we really know the full proper meaning of the word karma. I hear all sorts of strange things said about karma. Strange misconceptions, misinterpretations, and misleading ideas presented about karma. So let us look at this word first and then consider it together in depth, as far as I can present it to you in depth. The word karma, derived from the root kri, means to do or to make. That's what the dictionary tells us. But I think the dictionary omits the profoundest meaning of the word karma. It is not only to do or to make, which is a mechanical thing. It is to create. And it stands for that action which creates. Consider this matter very carefully. I think that the deepest meaning is this action of the primordial creative energy. In the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita of the Hindus, which is their great scripture, Sri Krishna says certain things. And Krishna is regarded by the Hindus as the incarnation of God himself. Because this aspect of Hinduism is theistic. And Krishna, the incarnate Lord, tells Arjuna, his disciple, if I did not engage in action, these worlds, all the worlds, would fall into ruin. It's in the third discourse, the 24th verse. Now consider, the Supreme Being, regarded as the creator of the entire universe, etc., etc., in the usual way, you see, says that if I did not engage in action, what sort of action is this? And he says that if I did not engage in action, all these worlds would fall into ruin. I like to present it this way. This action is the creative action of the primordial creative energy in eternity. Action in eternity. Therefore not subject to time or timelessness, not subject to any of the limitations which spring into being where we have a cosmos of any sort. Because the whole cosmos remains a cosmos under certain constraints which we call the laws of nature. This is absolutely free creative action. It is a pulse of creation which in very ancient times was regarded as a life-death pulse. Now, I can't see how we can regard it as a life-death pulse, because the creative activity of the supreme creative power cannot die. I prefer to call it a life, other life pulse, this pulse of creation. And it is of a very peculiar nature. It is a discontinuous throb, which is life, other life. Discontinuous. Like that. At an extraordinary speed, if I may use the word speed. Speed is a bad word because the idea of speed implies space and time. It's something measurable. Whereas this is entirely immeasurable. Each creation is new. It is not a reformulation or modification of the old. The creative pulse is non-repetitive. That means that it does not just reformulate or modify the old. It has no continuity in our meaning of the word continuity. It's very difficult to conceive this. How you can have this creative pulse which proceeds with extraordinary rapidity. You see how words are difficult in this context when you are talking of things which are transcendent. Rapidity again implies measurement and therefore restraint and all the rest of it. It has no continuity in our meaning of the word. We may say there is relationship between one pulse and another by virtue of each pulse of creation being a complete transmutation of the previous pulse. Hence, it's absolute newness every time. This is the absolute creative power, absolutely free, and therefore, as it expends its energy, uses its energy in this pulse of creation, it is new every time. This newness is one of the extraordinary things with respect to the context of the transcendent. As far as the context of the transcendent is concerned, everything is utterly new every time. It's a renewal, a recreation, but a new creation, not just a shifting around of the old furniture of the cosmos, so to say. In each new creation, there is nothing whatsoever of the previous creation which is identifiable. Naturally, we will ask questions here. How? How is it then that in everyday life, most things stay put and are identifiable, which indeed enables us to live as we do? First, we must bear in mind that we as we are understand procreation, biological and cultural, which is repetitive and true to type, with some modifications here and there, thus bringing forth the identifiable and that which is related to the known past. Now the creative pulse is of a different nature altogether. I can't put it into words. I can't put that difference into words. And next, that if any receptivity and capacity in us to respond to the creative pulse has at all begun to stir within us, it is so sluggish that we are aware of the actual discontinuity as a continuity, somewhat in the manner in which we are conscious of two pinpricks in sufficiently close proximity on the skin as a single sensation, or if we see a small flaming object twirled round sufficiently fast at the end of a wire, it appears as a continuous fire circle. So you see the limitations imposed upon us by our senses and the way we experience things makes it extremely difficult to imagine, to picture, and certainly to formulate the nature of this transcendent pulse of creation. But it is that which is the creative action in eternity which is karma in its supreme sense. It brings into being the entire cosmos. The law of karma is the law of divine or perfect justice. That's how it is, that's what we are taught. But karma is wrongly regarded by us as retributive justice, as nemesis. Now, this is understandable because when European scholars first came across these teachings and tried to translate the word karma, their minds were already conditioned because they were classical scholars, Latin and Greek. And in Greece, of course, there was the goddess Nemesis, who exacts retribution for all wrong done. And that was considered just. Retribution was considered just. And so we have that saying even in our day. Nemesis will catch up with this or that person in due time. Then again, karma is wrongly regarded as exact equilibration. This again is the result of our conditioning. Our dear friend Isaac Newton, one of the greatest scientists that the world produced, and mathematician, he enunciated the famous three laws of motion. That was a stroke of genius which was quite extraordinary. As extraordinary as the genius of Einstein in formulating what he formulated about the unity of space and time, a space-time continuum. Now, law of equilibration is the third law of Newton, presented as action and reaction are equal and opposite. Now this applies only in the sphere of mechanics. And of course the sphere of mechanics is rather a large sphere. There is the mechanical process of the whole cosmos as such. And here the law of action and reaction applies, being equal and opposite. But it does not apply in the true sense of the word karma as used in relation to ourselves and our life and so on. It is also regarded as an inflexible, rigid law of causation. And we associate it with the process of reward and punishment. Now, look at it this way. Karma is a word which represents the living process of the entire cosmos. That is this creative action which goes on all the time. The consequence of the original creative action in eternity, of which I can't say anything at all. But one can see it as manifested as the living process of the entire cosmos. It is in fact a single unitary process of unimaginable complexity. Now bear in mind, this means that the entire universe is acting as a unitary whole, and we are part and parcel of that unitary whole. The whole universe and ourselves are in constant interaction. Being separatively and not cosmically conscious, we see it as composed of countless bits and pieces. This is our difficulty. Our mode of awareness is isolative self-consciousness with respect to people and separative consciousness with respect to objects. So we split up everything and are aware of things and deal with things and look at things as separate bits and pieces. So we talk and think in terms of my karma and your karma. Or we say his karma or her karma, or sometimes we say the national karma. Now these are all mistaken ways of looking at it. Karma is a universal process. It is not you or I who have karma, but it would be far nearer the truth to say that karma has you or me. You or me are just infinitesimals in this great universal process of action, of cosmic action, you see. Now, every aspect of the total reality, be it an atom or a man or a galaxy, functions according to the inherent law of its being. This inherent law was presented first in the Rig Veda as Ritta. Ritta. And it implies that which exists in every single aspect of the cosmos. Every single thing has this. This law operates as an influence towards bringing that particular manifestation to fruition. You see, if we look at the animal kingdom, for instance, just as an example, a good lion is a perfect lion, a good bird is a perfect bird on the whole, and so on and so on. With us, it is different. Our fruition consists in becoming the full-fledged human. And the word human fundamentally means the happy or blissful creator. That is its fundamental meaning. And mind in its totality, in its fullness. I spoke about it yesterday, you remember. This archetypal form of the primordial creative energy which releases cosmos out of chaos. Mind has to come to fruition and function freely in us. Mind is perfect as it is, but when we are purified and perfect, that mind will function through us. So, as far as we are concerned, our task is this task of purification. And until that is carried out, we remain not fully human, but subhuman. I'm not using the word sub pejoratively. I'm using it as a statement of actual fact. We are still growing towards being the full-fledged human. So, it is this law, this ritta, this power within everything in the cosmos which brings things to fruition. The Greeks had a sense of this. When Aristotle particularly, when he used the word teleios, you see, and you'll find that Jesus uses the Aramaic word which corresponds to teleios, when he uses the word perfect. I'll come to that a little later. We, because of our inability to see the truth with unerring insight, can observe only partially and superficially. And our conditioned brain inevitably misinterprets to a considerable extent all that we experience. This is specially evidenced when we talk of retributive justice. Retribution or punishment is of the nature of vengeance, of deliberately inflicted pain, as contrasted with the pain that is the unavoidable consequence of any infringement of nature's laws. If we put our hand into the fire, the hand will get burnt. That is not retribution or punishment. It is just nature's laws operating. No one can stop that. This is one example of the manifestation of ritta as well as karma, manifestation of both. Retribution is rooted in hate, in fear, and unskill in action. I specially mention unskill in action because so many of you are interested in yoga. And if you have looked into the Gita, you will see Sri Krishna saying, yoga is skill in action. The Lord of the universe giving this instruction. Yoga is skill in action. And the action of Sri Krishna is this creative activity in eternity. So you can see the relationship between that, the Supreme, and this here, ourselves. Retribution or punishment maintains conflict and breeds more evil. It is not conducive to progressive change. The Buddha taught everything changes, and quite rightly, the whole of the scientific world nowadays knows that change is the outstanding characteristic of the entire cosmos, continuous change. It is not conducive to progressive change, which means growth and fruition. Change is we may generally class it as being of three kinds. Either it is just fortuitous, leads nowhere, it's just playing about or waste of time and energy and so forth. That sort of change is brought about that way. Then there is regressive change, change in which we go backwards. And there is progressive change, fortuitous, regressive, and progressive change. And punishment and retribution is not conducive to progressive change. It belongs to and confines us to the context of finitude, sorrow, decay, mortality, and bondage to dukkha. It does not heal, make whole, for it is not creative action, but karma. In its actuality, is creative action. And karma, strictly speaking, heals. That is real karma. Justice holds within itself mercy and compassion, patience and forbearance, understanding and wisdom. It is rooted in the infinite and the immortal. In arriving at its judgments, it is sensitive to many of the elements which compose the karmic process and has a vision of the relationship of these elements to the creative activity of karma. This is a power which persuasively moves us towards true fulfillment. Note carefully, persuasively moves us. Transcendence never compels. Because that which is the fount of the infinite, the eternal and the transcendence knows no such thing as compulsion. Doesn't force anything at all. The laws of nature which constrain us from certain things and from certain modes of action are the laws of the manifestations which comes into being when a cosmos is produced by this creative activity. Thus we see that the phrase retributive justice is a self-contradictory term, quite misrepresenting karma. There is no such thing as retributive justice where karma is concerned. And in fact, to associate the word justice with retribution is obviously a mistake. It's a self-contradictory term altogether. Now, the perfected holy ones knew all this too well. Thus, Jesus taught in his Sermon on the Mount, it's Matthew, I'm reading from Matthew chapter 5. Ye have heard that it was said to them of old time, Thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you, that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raka, thou fool, shall be in danger of the council, and in danger of the hell of fire. Ye have heard it was said, Thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, that everyone that looketh on a woman to lust after her, hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. And then he goes on from verse 38 of chapter 5. Ye have heard that it was said, An eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth, and a life for a life. But I say unto you, Resist not him that is evil, but whosoever smiteth thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And of course, people imagine this is an extraordinary thing to say, I've got a lot of pain on one cheek, why should I have pain on the other cheek? But what Jesus possibly had in mind, I won't say probably, I dare not pretend to intrude into the mind of a Jesus. What Jesus possibly had in mind was this, turn to him the right, if he smites thee on one cheek, turn to him the other. When? When you have seen that the person who smote you has changed and wishes to make amends and to make it right with you. All right? So you turn the other cheek, not to be smitten, but to be kissed. Perhaps that is an interesting way of looking at it. And if any man would go to law with thee and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go 1 mile, go with him twain. Perhaps during the second mile, you may say something or do something or something may happen which will convert that man. So go with him 2 miles instead of 1. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. And so on. It goes on. That is what Jesus said. And this surely is an example which shows that justice heals. Justice neither rewards karmic, the karmic law neither rewards nor punishes. But it heals. And justice is intended really to heal. That means that both the wrongdoer and the wrong done, both have to be put into right relationship, and there is complete harmony between the two of them. Jesus taught these things in his Sermon on the Mount, as it is called. I would prefer to call it the Sermon from the Mount. You see that chapter 5 starts by saying that when Jesus saw the multitudes and he had pity on them, they came to him to be healed, he went up into the mountain. What is this mount? The Mount of the Lord, as it was called in the Hebrew texts. Those people knew their yoga all right. And this mount is the Sahasrara Chakra at the top of the head. This is the mount referred to. It is called Ushidarena in the Zarathustrian scriptures. It's called Mount Meru in the Hindu scriptures. And it means, therefore, we could interpret it this way, that Jesus entered into one of the profound states of consciousness. meditative states, the truly meditative states. Because if you look at the whole of that fifth chapter, it's an inspired statement which does not come merely out of a logical brain. It is something truly creative. So, the Sermon from the Mount, I would prefer than saying the Sermon on the Mount. If he went up onto the top of a mountain and the multitudes were below, he would have to have an extraordinarily loud voice in order to be heard. Now, let us see what the Buddha said in this connection. In that marvelous discourse, the Kakachupama Sutta, the parable of the saw with which you cut wood. He's talking to his monks about how they should behave when somebody either speaks to them harshly or treats them cruelly in any way. And he ends up by giving a very dramatic situation. Monks, even if low-down thieves might carve you limb from limb with a double-handled saw, even then, whoever sets his mind at enmity, he for this reason is not a doer of my teaching. Herein, monks, you should train yourselves thus. Neither will our minds become perverted, nor will we utter an evil speech, but kindly and compassionate will we dwell, even when we are being sawn limb from limb. And we will dwell with a mind of friendliness, void of hatred. And beginning with him, we will dwell having suffused the whole world with a mind of friendliness that is far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable, without enmity, without malevolence. This is how you must train yourselves, monks. Not quite an easy task. But there we are. That is the actual teaching. But you see the point. Healing. If one is capable of suffusing the whole world, or leave the whole world to start with, if one is capable of suffusing the person who hurts you with this kind of mind of friendliness, widespread, far-reaching, immeasurable, it means that one has taken many steps towards becoming the perfected Holy One. And there is real justice done. Because by doing this, you heal the wrongdoer. It's difficult to believe this. But the great teachers of the world did teach such things. Now, it is rather interesting. Aristotle, in his treatise on ethics, the Nicomachean Ethics as they are called, and I think they are called Nicomachean because his father's name was Nicomachus, and he may have sort of felt like dedicating the work to his father. So they have come down as the Nicomachean Ethics. In Book 5, Chapter 2, remember, what is called a book by Aristotle is really only a chapter, and what is called a chapter is just a section, short section. In Book 5, Chapter 2, Aristotle says, justice is the practice of virtue towards others. Most instructive that one of the greatest of the Greek philosophers, the most distinguished pupil of Plato, said that justice is the practice of virtue towards others. Makes us think that when we want justice done to us with respect to somebody who has done us wrong, we have to practice virtue towards the wrongdoer. It is true that in the last chapter, I forget which, he talks of corrective justice. But he does not imply by that any cruelty, or retribution, or any cruel punishment. Plato, in his Republic, in section 433, that's, I think, comes in the sixth book or fifth book, I forget again. But it's section 433. In the Republic, he uses this phrase, taxis kai kosmos, which means literally in good order. In good order, and he explains that in some detail in the previous pages, and it implies an order and beauty which represents the cosmic workings as such. And we can translate it as an effective harmony of the whole. That is justice, to bring about an effective harmony of the whole. You can't bring about any harmony of the whole if you are going to exercise retribution or inflict punishment upon somebody. Because inevitably a hate reaction, a revenge reaction is set up in his psyche, and he's going to have it on you one day. That's the sort of instinctive reaction, the animal reaction. After all, we are descended from some primordial animal ancestor. We mustn't forget that. So we have some of these traits in us. Now, since the operation of karma is in the direction of growth, healing, and fruition, it is not mere equilibration, action and reaction being equal and opposite. That is static. There is no growth, no progress involved in that. Action and reaction are equal and opposite. And if we apply the idea of equal and opposite reaction, then it could mean that if we did good, we'd get the opposite, evil, as the consequence, which is, of course, obviously absurd. So you see, the whole idea of equilibration must be cut out. It's a static idea. It gets you no farther at all. And as a matter of fact, it just does not take place that way, simply because the whole universe is an evolving, changing universe, a growing universe, a universe which is moving towards fruition. Not reaction, but response is the right way to look at it. Something happens to us, something comes to us from somebody, we'll say. Well, we have to respond to that in the right way. And the right response is, of course, completely embodied in the teachings of the great ones. I have just quoted the Jesus and the Buddha. Rigid causation, again, does not and cannot hold in a continuously changing cosmos. Rigid causation cannot hold there. And we know today that the causality of classical mechanics and physics definitely does not hold in the subatomic world. So those mechanical ideas which we have must be completely given up where understanding karma is concerned. I don't know whether I mentioned yesterday, if we want to understand in depth and have insight into truth, the living truth of the living process of our own being and of the whole world, then start from transcendence itself, from the Supreme, not from where we are. Because where we are is the state of muddlement, is the state of dukkha, of confusion and conflict and so on. Start from the transcendent itself. And if you get your touch, even a touch with transcendence, the sense of transcendence awakes in you and guides you unerringly in step by step in your own life. The Buddha taught that in the cosmos there is nothing that remains unchanging. In the ceaseless flux of the universal becoming process, the immediate prevailing state changes in the very next split second into the new state. Through the centuries, we have talked of this as cause and effect. It might be better to talk of it as present state and transformed state. If we use these words, cause and effect, we must clearly see that cause and effect are not separate from each other, but that cause becomes effect, which in turn is the cause of the next change, the next state which it will reach. So it is just a continuous process like that. And you'd find it extremely difficult to separate out cause and effect, apart from very simple things. Supposing I push this book, deliberately push this book over the table, it'll fall down on the floor, of course. That's the effect of this cause. But karma is not such a super simple thing. The Buddha saw this and declared, this being that becomes, this is the important thing, this being becomes that. That which it becomes is commonly called the effect, and this is called the cause. But it is better to regard it as present state and transformed state. And we must see that the becoming is according to the law of karma. Namely, that whatever is or occurs at any point instant in space-time is the resultant of the sum total of forces acting on that point at that instant. Point and instant both belong to the transcendent context. Both are immeasurable and belong to that. So you see, the transcendent and the manifested, the perishing world, are intensely interrelated. Don't conceive of the transcendent as an other, unrelated to this. The transcendent and this are completely a unitary whole. This represents all the forces at play, the whole universe, that is. That represents, again, the whole of the transformed state, also the whole universe. If we realize this, be fully conscious of this, we will be perfectly holy. Cease to be producers of dukkha, and we shall swim contrary to the stream of suffering which engulfs all that lives. If justice is the practice of virtue towards others, as Aristotle said, or that which brings about an effective harmony of the whole, how does karma work with justice? Now, consider natural disasters, earthquake, volcano, flood, drought, forest fires, plagues and epidemics. And also consider man-inflicted calamities, wars, strikes, murder, arson, robbery, poverty, treachery, violence, misgovernment, harsh laws, cruelty, false teachings. These are man-inflicted calamities. If there is an earthquake, hundreds, maybe thousands of people suffer death, suffer destruction in so many ways. Now we ask, where is the justice of this? And those who superficially look into karma say, oh, that was that person's karma. He did something in the past or whatever it was, which had deserved this. I consider this utterly nonsensical and absurd. There is nothing which you or I or any single individual can do for which he is the sole, the only responsible agent. Whatever we think, for example, is not just our thought. There have been so many influences, other people talking to us, speaking to us, our reading and our being taught by our teachers and so forth. All these things have contributed towards what we think or feel and so forth. And that is particularly so with action. There is not a single action for which the individual alone is solely responsible. There are many others responsible together with him. Now, take a case like this. A man and wife conjugate on the 1st of January. On the 7th, 6th or 7th of October, there comes a baby. The baby comes after a period of 280 days, averagely. All right. During those 280 days, whilst it was still in the fetus, the mother went through all kinds of experiences, ate all kinds of food and this, that and the other and so forth. A hundred thousand influences played their part in determining the growth of that fetus, you see. And supposing the mother made certain mistakes in the way she carried on, then that baby would suffer physically in consequence for it. No good saying that that baby in its past life did something for which it is suffering. That's utter nonsense. Consider also the mental, the psychical life of the mother and the psychical influences which have played their part in that family. All those influences affect that child. Consider again, here is a newborn child, and if there is an epidemic, if something goes wrong in the country, etc., all those things affect the child. An accident may take place. The baby may fall out of its pram on its head and injure its brain and suffer from goodness knows what, polio or concussion or something, and be a cripple for life. Now, it's no good saying that that was that child's karma from the past. No one is solely responsible. We are all interrelated. There is a complete and total interaction between all things which make up the cosmos and each and every single individual. And the karmic process, do remember, works from split second to split second. Whatever forces are in operation at this split second have given rise to the state of the universe in the next split second. There is no such thing as an accumulation of karma which produces its effect afterwards. Besides, consider, who records the doings and keeps a ledger account? Who does it? It is inherent in the operation of Ritta and in the operation of karma. It is inherent in the nature of things as such. But there is no record kept. And how are you to measure what shall be meted out for this, that or the other thought or action? How are you to measure it? It's totally impossible to do anything of the sort. And it is just not done, believe me. These things happen. All sorts of things happen. We have to take them in our stride as well as we can and understand, as far as lies in our power to understand, what we have done here and now to contribute towards this, that or the other happening. But do remember that no one person is the sole agent. Consider then supposing there is a saint and a sinner walking together discussing high philosophy. They are walking, say, on the south coast, and they are so engrossed in their conversation that they topple over Beachy Head. You see? All right. Sinner and saint meet with just one end. And people say, oh, how unjust for the saint, and how deserving for the sinner. What utter rubbish. This is what happened. This is nature at work. Here were two people. One was a sinner, one was a saint. All right. But here were two people walking along and not being sufficiently mindful of where they were walking, made a single false step, unfortunately, and down they went. Now, nature does not suspend her laws for the sake of the saint in favor of the saint against the consequence to the sinner. Nature does not, nature cannot do that. This is how things happen. And if we understand our life and what happens to us in our life in that way, we shall be able to respond rightly to whatever comes along to us. This is one of the absurdities with respect to karma. Now take the extreme, the most terrible example of it all, the atomic bomb. Today, the Hiroshima's atomic bomb killed off 100,000 people and maimed and destroyed the lives of so many others. A modern hydrogen bomb would kill off 3 million people. 3 million people. Now I ask you, a war breaks out, and in the course of this war, a hydrogen bomb is dropped on a populous, a densely populated city. 3 million people are killed out. Are you going to tell me that all those 3 million people did this, that, or the other in the past to deserve this sort of extermination? It's the sheerest nonsense that was ever propounded. This idea of you did it in the past, unto you it shall be meted out. St. Paul's statement, which Mr. Humphreys quoted last night, as ye sow, so shall ye reap, is a very inadequate and misleading statement altogether. Because he should have been more careful to perceive that it is that whatever is done by one person is not exclusively his sowing. There are so many hundreds of influences, hundreds of other people and situations and so on, all involved in any one action and so forth. So this idea, and as I say, this idea of deserving, how are you to measure what is to be deserved and so forth? Look at it in the broad way and realize that we cannot sort of give a foolproof, watertight explanation of all the causes at work and so forth. You see? And then one will be able to function compassionately. Not in terms of this person deserved this sorrow or punishment and so forth, or that person deserved something good. When we get something good, we are very pleased put it up in the ledger account as such and such a good deed in the past. That's just self-conceit, vanity and pride and egoism and all the rest of it. You see? No. So we have to bear these things thoroughly in mind. What is troublesome, the trouble starts because of our ideas of justice. You see, we have the sort of shopkeeper mentality where justice is concerned. So and so did such and such a wrong to this man. All right, he shall be fined £100 or £1,000. How do you equate £100 as the value of the wrong done? How do you equate it? You can't do it. It's absurd. All right, so the trouble lies with our concepts of justice. And note how they change with the passage of time. Our ideas of justice are bound up with our ethics, our ideas of right and wrong. But our ethics and our ideas of right and wrong simply do not apply to nature's laws. Look at those two charming gentlemen who fell over Beachy Head. You see? It just doesn't apply. And we mete out reward and punishment accordingly. Consider the Mosaic law. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, life for a life, and so on and so on. It's in chapter 21 of Exodus, particularly verses 12 to 25. Consider Roman law with all its harshness. Consider Draco's code in ancient Greece in 621 BC. He was a simpleton. He decreed death for each and every single offense. That's what he decreed. That's how we have the English word draconian. Draconian law, you see. And consider India in the Buddha's time. If you look in the Majjhima Nikaya, volume 1, page 87, or in the Anguttara Nikaya, volume 1, pages 42 and 43, you will be harrowed to read of the cruel and terrible punishments that were meted out. Absolutely harrowed. You can't believe that India, which had been through the golden age of the Upanishads and all that sort of thing, you see, and had wonderful examples of great teachers and holy men and so forth, that such laws could be in operation where the mass of the people were concerned. The Buddha talks of them in detail. And if you look at the Anguttara volume, pages 42 and 43, volume 1 of the translation, you will find the description of those punishments given. In the Majjhima, only the name of the punishment is given. If you like, you can look at it here. I've anybody interested, after the meeting, come and have a look. And consider again the system of justice, as they called it, in the time of as presented in Kautilya's Arthashastra, in the time of Chandragupta Maurya, 321 to 300 BC. They are ghastly punishments. Consider again the terrible punishments inflicted in China. And if you read a book which came out in the beginning of this century, I had it myself, and it really shook me. It was by Ekai Kawaguchi. He was 3 years in Tibet, and one of his chapters deals with the sort of punishments that were inflicted in Tibet in our present age. They're appalling, unbelievable, but there it is. Consider the state of the law in Europe and in England up to the 19th century. In the last century, for stealing bread, a loaf of bread and so forth, even children were hanged. And children were flogged when their father, who was a murderer, was hanged, as an example to the others to deter them from such things. Now you see, it's no good saying that this was the operation of karma. It had nothing to do with karma as such. This is the stupidity and the horrible nature of subhumans. That's what it is actually. The operation of karma is something which heals, which makes whole. And only love and wisdom can heal. So we must cut out all these ideas. And today, as far as the world as a whole is concerned, contrast Islamic law with non-Islamic law. How did vengeance and barbaric cruelty play such a part in the sphere of justice? Through the ages, the relationship between people has been one of reaction, tit for tat. That has been the normal, ordinary behavior of human beings throughout the world, which is not a true human response. It is a subhuman response, reaction. These reactions express the primitive passions of undeveloped subhumans, their fears and hates. But where nomadic people live, justice had to be unsparingly stern for the sake of survival. It's a very interesting thing historically to observe how the law had to be stern with nomadic tribes. They were small tribes and they were always in danger of extermination by hostile tribes unless everyone belonging to the tribe very strictly obeyed the law. Our inherent pleasure-pain mechanism has dominantly influenced our ideas of justice, hence the reward-punishment or incentive-deterrent elements in systems of justice. Frustration of desire, pleasure, ambition, self-expression, and so on, arouses hate and fear and violence, which moves us to hurt or destroy that which stands in our way, or opposes, or frustrates us. And we believe it is right to do so. Even great philosophers like Fichte and Hegel, during the latter part of the 18th, yes, and in the 19th century. Leave alone men like Hitler, they upheld the ruthless extermination of whatever stood in the way of the fulfillment of the great ego. It really is extraordinary. Both Fichte and Hegel produced marvelous philosophy in so many ways. I've read through these things, you see, and but where this idea of anything obstructing the fulfillment of the great ego was concerned, he had the right to ruthlessly exterminate all opposition. You see how this philosophy, and also the writings of Richard Wagner, bless his heart, he ought not to have done it, but still he did. All that he wrote against the Jews, and the way he decried Jewish composers and so forth, all that played its part in ultimately producing a Hitler. Savage, subhuman action in the name of justice flourished because man had no vision of the purpose of his existence. No idea of his divine potential, of his own real nature. But through the centuries, there have been the few realized humans in whom that divine potential had come to fruition. They saw clearly that the purpose of justice was not to punish the evildoer or reward the good doer, but to heal, to release all human beings into the state of holiness. You remember how in the New Testament you read of the blind man who was brought to Jesus, and Jesus was asked, who hath sinned that he is blind, this man or his parents? And Jesus says, neither of them has sinned, but in order he is blind, in order that the greatness of God may be made manifest. And then he heals that blind man and tells him, don't tell anybody what happened. Very, very wise, but there you are, unfortunately he did. It's very, very interesting. You see, this is karma, this is justice, in the deep, profound, wonderful sense, the true sense, I feel. Consider the words of Jesus. This comes right at the end of chapter 5, the Sermon on the Mount chapter, in Matthew. Be therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. I said at the beginning of our meeting, I mentioned the word teleios, and the word, the Greek word here in this context is teleios for perfect. Teleios means finished in the sense of brought to perfection. It's finished that way. Just as we think of, say, the compositions of Mozart as such finished compositions. So perfectly, the finished craftsmanship of the thing, you see, in that sense. Be perfect, therefore, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. Like the Buddha, Zarathustra, Krishna, and all true spiritual teachers, Jesus used all his energy to help all people to grow towards perfection. And to this end, instead of punishing or rewarding anyone, note how he behaved when the woman caught in adultery was brought to him and so forth. He just kept writing in the sand. And what he wrote, no one seems to know. And he rubbed it out afterwards. But one by one, his accusers, the accusers of the woman, came and looked at what he was writing. And you know, Cecil B. DeMille, in a marvelous film of his, I think it was called King of Kings, yes, that's it. In that film, he makes out, when the man came, he would write thief, and when the other man came, adulterer, etc., etc. So each man, seeing this, you see, shrunk back and dropped the stone which he was going to throw at the woman. That was marvelously done. It was profoundly touching, so touching that I'll never forget it as long as I live. And to this end, instead of punishing or rewarding anyone, he gave his own life as a ransom for the many. Now, so many people find this, they have a revulsion towards this idea that Jesus gave his life as a ransom for the many. But read Suzuki's introduction, page 19, to his translation of the Lankavatara Sutra, in which he says that the Gandharva and Prajna Paramita are quite eloquent in elucidating the doctrine of vicarious suffering. And you know, vicarious suffering takes place all the time, where there is love, where there is understanding. The parent who suffers because of the child's ailment or whatever it is, or whatever ill happens to the child or is done by the child. The children's suffering with respect to their parents, when there is real love, or in relation to one's own friends and so forth, there is constant vicarious suffering taking place. And it's right and proper that there should be this vicarious suffering, because unless we suffered with the sufferings of another, compassion could never come out of us. The very word compassion, passion, the deep meaning is to suffer. And com is with, to suffer together with. When you suffer together with somebody, the power of compassion naturally and spontaneously flows out of you, and it is a healing agent. It is just, it is karma in its grand sense. Jesus himself suffered crucifixion in order to redeem the world of its sinful state. This was a manifestation of divine justice. Forgive me for saying shocking things, but it is a manifestation of divine justice. The harmony of the whole at a transcendental level is represented in this. And this is how true justice works. It includes martyrdom. Such divine justice manifests karma as creative action in eternity. So also does the Buddha's acquiescence to teach the Dhamma on Brahma Sahampati's entreaty to men to beat the drum of deathlessness and open the doors of the deathless state. All this is a manifestation of true justice, of the true workings of karma. The ceaseless creative action in eternity of karma manifests through nature's trend for progressive change, which is growth towards fruition. In the living cell, there is the power for self-healing. In man is embodied the moral imperative, the correspondent of Ruddha on the cosmic scale. It is perhaps man's most direct and saving link with transcendence itself. Perfect religious living is possible if we live in accord with the teachings of the perfected holy ones, in which the moral teachings are of primary importance. It's a very interesting thing that the Rig Vedic Aryans in the Rig Veda present Varuna as the first great deity of in the Rig Vedic pantheon. And he is the moral governor of the universe. In the truly healed or holy state, there is also in the truly healed or holy state, there is, and also there is not, pleasure or pain, joy or sorrow. All these are ephemeral. As the permanent background to all this, there is constantly present, in the truly healed and holy state, only the great peace, perfect poise and equanimity, bliss, ananda, the sublime unoriginated nirvana. The question is, we who are separatively self-conscious and are probably likely to remain so, quite true, how are we then to act in the world without scarring the tree of life? I'm sure the person who asked this is deeply interested in the inner meanings of the Pentateuch, the books of Moses particularly. The tree of life, when the tree of life is scarred, it becomes the tree of good and evil. What is the tree of life? The tree of life, remember, is planted in the middle of the Garden of Eden. And the Genesis says that the tree of good and evil is also in the middle of the Garden of Eden. I'd like to see a garden in which two trees grew exactly in one spot. The meaning is this. The tree of life refers in its pristine purity to the brain, nervous system, the spine all the way down, and all the chakras that are associated with this tree as such. This is the tree of life. The Garden of Eden is this, your own psychophysical organism. That is the real Garden of Eden. Now, the hint of this is seen in the Gita, where Sri Krishna talks of the Ashwatha tree, which is the tree of life as such, with roots above and branches below. going out. It's the brain, that is the root, and the whole nervous system and the spine. Now, Adam in the Garden of Eden was on speaking terms with God. What does that mean? He was in the pristine creation of man. There he was able to enter the deep states of consciousness and be in communion with transcendence. The Bible puts it this way: do not eat of the fruit of the tree of evil. But actually what happens is this: one plucks the fruit of the tree of life before one is ready to pluck it. The fruit of the tree of life is consciousness. The consciousness of the divine, which is embodied in oneself. Transcendence is embodied in every one of us. And the fruit of that tree is the full consciousness of that divinity. You remember the words of Jesus? I and the Father are one. It's that consciousness. Remember what the Hindus say? Pratyagatma and Paramatma are one. When one has realized the state of perfect holiness, perfect purity. So the fruit, that consciousness, if it awakes only partially, then it causes great trouble and turmoil. And the tree of life is scarred. The word scarred is my own word, actually. And it is converted into the tree of good and evil. Because instead of being the whole consciousness, the all-inclusive consciousness, which is the supreme consciousness, it becomes discriminative consciousness, vijnana. The discriminative consciousness which analyzes, which separates out whatsoever thought or feeling or act is performed, which separates out things and spoils or hurts the unity of the universe, is sin. So it becomes the tree of good and evil, because with that discrimination, the good is that which is agreeable and pleasant to the man, and what is evil is the disagreeable and unpleasant. You see? So now, how are we then to act in the world without scarring the tree of life? Be totally mindful all the time. There is the secret. Merely practicing laid down systems of meditation and so forth won't do it. The only real meditation is this perpetual mindfulness. Let every sense be active and registering what it has to register. And let the deeper part of the mind in you, the most concrete part is the brain, and at first it will have to be the brain which sort of looks and understands what is happening and renounces everything that tends to evil. And in that process, ultimately, that mindfulness reaches the point where you realize communion with the Supreme. And then the tree of life remains altogether unscarred. But it's a long process. Now you will ask, obviously this implies that one must have many, many lives to do it. Not at all. It is not you or I who achieve or attain anything like that. It is transcendence which comes to fruition through us. Our task is the purification, the cleaning of the temple. In the New Testament, I think it's St. Paul in Corinthians 1. Know ye not that ye are the temple of the Most High? The word, the Greek word used is naos, nu, alpha, omicron, sigma. Naos. Know ye not ye are the temple of the Most High? And in the Skanda and the Maitreya Upanishads, this is said: the body is the temple. The dweller in the temple is Shiva. Each one of us as an individual is the keeper of the temple, the caretaker of the temple, like we have a caretaker in a church, you see. And his business is to keep the temple clean. And when the temple is clean, the Lord himself functions freely through that temple. All right?